My observations on Washington in 1948-49, particularly 1949. In order to really understand the political climate of the 81st Congress, you have to understand Washington itself. I've commented already upon the Harry Truman having won a great victory from the people. It still was not accepted by the big money, big business, the press, and the commentators. Harry Truman, of course, received the applause and the congratulations of everyone immediately after his election. And then the opposition settled in to start to do everything it could to destroy him and to weaken him. There was a bitterness about politics in those days that continued to bring out the worst in people. The Republicans had been out of power from the presidency since 1932, and they were becoming more desperate all the time to gain power. Their leadership in the Senate was becoming ever more critical and cynical and negative. That leadership was characterized by the strong leadership of Bob Taft, and later on by Kenneth Wherry of Nebraska. Those that were elected in 1946, Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, Jenner of Indiana, Homer Capehart of Indiana, Dworshak of Idaho, and others of that conservative stripe were relentless in their attacks upon Mr. Truman and the Democratic Party. Communism was the charge, radicalism, socialism, and anything that, and those persons like myself who were affiliated with ADA, who had the support of the labor movement, who were looked upon as liberals or progressives, were under bitter assault and attack from the right-wing elements of the Republican Party and some of the spokesmen that I've mentioned. This was the climate, the political climate. Add to that, as I said, the hostility of the Southerners, and particularly the Southern press and some of the Southern segregationists. We were just in the early days of the civil rights movement now, and the Southerners and the Southern establishment was fighting back ferociously. Truman was looked upon as their mortal enemy, and I was looked upon as the apostle of Harry Truman and one of his frontline fighters. So I found the political environment in the Senate of the United States to be very different from that which I had experienced in Minnesota or even in other parts of the country. I don't know of any time when I have seen the Congress or the Senate so different from the will of the people. The Senate was conservative. The Senate was at times downright reactionary. And yet the country had just elected Harry Truman. The country had placed into the Senate in the elections of 1948 a number of outstanding progressives and liberals. But the control of that body and the control of the committees and the structure of the Senate was in the hands of the conservatives, the Republicans, and the Southern Democrats, and what Northern Democrats were conservative. In other words, nothing was left to chance. Everything was highly organized to maintain the status quo, to fight against the liberal and progressive programs of Harry Truman. There was a force at work which was still bitterly anti-Roosevelt, anti-New Deal. And I don't know of any time that the press of the nation, particularly as it emanated out of Washington, was more bitter towards the Democratic leadership and party than in the 1948 to 1952 period. Well, it was into this social political environment that I moved and worked. And it was anything but friendly and conducive to a good reception. Washington, D.C. itself was, as I said earlier, more southern than the most southern city. It was a totally segregated city. The fire department was segregated, the police department. Even the Howard Johnsons and the hamburger stands, the hotels were segregated. The whole community was strictly strictly segregated along racial lines, and even, may I say, along economic lines. Washington, D.C. did not have a strong labor movement. It had no industry. Its only business was government and real estate. The Board of Trade in Washington, similar to a local chamber of commerce, was one of the most conservative business organizations in the United States. The Real Estate Board was more conservative than the Board of Trade. So you found a very beautiful city physically that was in the control of the most reactionary and conservative elements of business and politics. This, to me, was not only a surprise but a shock. Coming from Minneapolis, where we had just established our Commission on Civil Rights, where we had adopted a Fair Employment Practices Ordinance, where we had really quite progressive views, even Republicans as well as Democrats, it seemed inconceivable that the nation's capital could be this way, but there it was. And there was I, the living symbol of all that the political and conservative business establishment thought evil and bad. The National Manufacturers Association, the NAM, a powerful conservative influence in the capital and throughout the country. The Chamber of Commerce at that time, very conservative. I think we have forgotten how much change has really taken place in these last few, in the last 20 years. How our country has changed not only physically, not only in some of its institutions, but in its attitudes. Things that we're doing today would have been considered impossible. The NAM fought with everything at its command, any talk even about civil rights or any talk about fair employment practices. And yet in 1968, the National Association of Manufacturers, 20 years later, was conducting seminars teaching businessmen how to comply with the Fair Employment Practices Law, encouraging compliance for that law and praising it, all within 20 years. The Chamber of Commerce in 1968, talking about the necessity of opening up our cities, developing the inner city, equal employment opportunities, job opportunities. In 1948, 1949, was bitterly opposed to the minimum wage, bitterly opposed to collective bargaining, strongly in support of the Taft-Hartley Law, bitterly opposed to any kind of federal aid to education. 20 years later, all of this had changed. Well, this was the Washington that I found in 1948 and 49. And it was a Washington that found Hubert Humphrey strongly in support of programs of health care, of the programs for our farmers, the building of cooperatives. Programs of assistance to our schools. I found Washington in 1948 and 49 dominated by the NAM, the American Medical Association, the Chamber of Commerce, a number of other conservative groups. The AMA led a bitter fight against not only health insurance, but against all forms of federal assistance to medical care, even against such things as the National Institutes of Health. And here I was, a young senator, joining with Senator Murray and others to propose forms of health insurance. In 1949, actually proposing hospital and medical care under the terms of Social Security for persons age 65 and over, proposing group health assistance, that is, assistance to group health programs. All of these things bitterly opposed by the AMA, and they would attack those of us who supported them as if we were enemies of the Republic. There was bitter opposition to even a civil rights commission, even voluntary FEPC. And here I was an advocate of compulsory equal employment opportunities legislation, an advocate of increasing Social Security benefits and of expanding its coverage, an advocate of public housing, and of urban renewal and urban redevelopment, many of these things being strongly opposed by the conservative elements of our press, by the powerful economic and business interests of our country. Those business and economic interests were really fighting a last-ditch battle. They had hoped that they could weaken President Truman so that he would not be able to sustain his battle for these things. They did not succeed. Well, when I stop and think of those early days in the Senate, I must say that I surely played right into the hands of our opposition in many ways, and yet also stood my ground. When you were a co-sponsor of the Missouri Valley Authority, this meant that the powerful utility interests, the private interests, would oppose you. When you were a co-sponsor of National Health Insurance, this meant that you engaged the wrath of the American Medical Association and all of its affiliates. When you supported the farm cooperative movement and firm price supports, it meant that you got the total opposition of the American Farm Bureau, which had become a much more conservative farm organization and a very powerful one with connections in the press and in the financial community. When you supported extension of the minimum wage for new workers to cover thousands, yes, millions of new workers, it meant that you engaged that you attracted the animosity and opposition of vast elements in the business and industrial community. When you advocated repeal of the Taft-Hartley law, you were taking on the entire corporate establishment. And all of these things I was doing. At the same time, I was opposing the seniority system in the Congress, feeling that it was wrong and feeling that that something had to be done to change it. I was also opposing Harry Byrd's committee known as the Committee on Non-Essential Expenditures. I felt that it was useless. I felt that it was wasting money, that all it was doing was making new reports out of old statistical material, that it didn't do anything to cut back expenditures, and what it did was to provide some jobs for a few Virginians who were on Mr. Byrd's payroll or were on his patronage. Well, I had the audacity to challenge Senator Harry Flood Byrd, who was the darling of the most of the conservatives of this country, a quiet man, but a powerful political figure with a powerful political machine in Virginia that had dominated that state from the 1930s up until the 1900s, up through the 1960s. And I found him at the very zenith of his power in 1949, a man who had been a presidential contender, a man who had opposed Franklin Roosevelt, a man who had been governor of his state and who ran a political machine second to none, a powerful United States senator. And I decided to challenge the very the authority of his committee, its very existence, the very reason for its existence. I said the most non-essential expenditure of the Congress of the United States was the funds that were being appropriated to conduct the activities of the Committee on Non-Essential Expenditures, because that committee didn't save anybody any money. All it did was provide a few jobs for a few friends and relatives of the senator from Virginia. Now, I was a brash man, young man, so they said, and that's what was said in the press, and particularly in the southern press and in the press in Washington and vicinity. I must confess that when I made this attack, I had all kinds of evidence from the American Political Science Association as to the justice of my cause, but I learned that the American Political Science Association doesn't carry much weight in the Senate of the United States, particularly when it's under conservative control. And I delivered my speech, well documented, pointing out the inadequacies and the downright wastefulness of the of Senator Byrd's committee, only to have one senator after another come in and launch a bitter personal attack upon me for having had the audacity to even challenge the work of the committee of Senator Byrd's committee. It was a massive attack upon this brash young senator from Minnesota that dared to open his mouth in examination of one of the sinecures of the Senate, one of the bastions of power. And I found out that when you attack a man like Senator Byrd, you better have more than just facts, because facts do not convince very many people. And the only senator that came to my defense in that entire period, and it lasted for a full day, was Senator Millard Tydings of Maryland. And his defense was simply that I was entitled to make this examination and that possibly some good could come out of it. He, in a sense, put his arm around me and told me, don't be afraid. You have a right as a senator to do what you're doing, and these men here ought to treat you with more kindliness and respect. It wasn't a strong defense, but it was a friendly word. And let me tell you, after having had 25 to 30 or more Democrats and Republicans attack me personally for even daring to even comment adversely upon Senator Byrd and his committee, it was Senator Tiding's words were like the tender loving care of a mother when you're sick. I recall at the end of that day when I had been attacking the committee on non-essential expenditures and then had received the blistering counterattack of Senator Byrd's friends, including Senator Walter George of Georgia, Senator McCarran of Tennessee, Senator Robert Taft, and many others. I recall at the end of the day getting on the elevator to go back to the Senate office building, and lo and behold, I came face to face to Senator Byrd. And I said to the senator, "Well, I know when I've been licked." And I said, I put my hand out, and he extended his hand, and we shook hands. I'm sure that it wasn't a friendly handshake, but at least it represented the courtesy of the Senate. The next day, one of my assistants came to me and said, "Oh, I have some new material for you. You ought to go back now and open this case up again. And I think this time," said this assistant, "you will be able to gain support." And I said, "Listen, you go do it. I'm not going to make any more effort on Senator Byrd. I know when I've had it." And he kept pursuing me, saying that this is new material from the from some professional association, either the Economics Association or the Historical Society or the American Political Science Association. And I said, "I wouldn't care if it were a chapter out of the Bible. I'm not about ready to open up another attack upon Senator Byrd. I said, I know when I've been walloped, and I know when I've been worked over, and I know when I've been beaten. And I'm the guy that has to take it. All you have to do is to hand me the ammunition. The trouble is that what you're giving me are blanks, and I'm running into a massive counterattack." So that ended that little episode in my life. But believe me, I found out where the power was in the Senate, and I also found out what you could expect when you challenged that power. Now, the first 2 years of my work in the Senate were characterized by some fortunate events, however. I remember one of my first votes in the Senate was on a federal aid to education bill, and I voted for that bill. It was defeated subsequently in the House, as I found out that this would be the pattern for years to come. We'd pass it in the Senate, it would be defeated in the House. It was always either being defeated by the issue of states' rights, religion, or race. There were those who said if you pass it, it'll only be used for the Negro. There were others who say that if you pass it, it'll be help for parochial schools. There are others that say that if you pass federal aid to education, it will diminish the power of the states and the federal government will start to control education. So every time the Senate would pass a bill on federal aid to education, it would be defeated in the House. Or if the House passed it, it would be defeated in the Senate. It was like a tennis game with the return serve always being a net ball. One of the other measures that one of the very first things that happened in the Senate was a bill designed to bring federal penalties to anyone that would engage in lynching. It was a civil rights bill, and a major filibuster took place, and that filibuster was successful. I recall that we got something like 50 some votes to break it, but it took 60. More than 60 to, it took two-thirds of all those present and voting, so that we were unable to break the filibuster. Also, one found out where the real liberal strength rested. In those first 2 years, We passed an agricultural bill. I found out there, however, that you could have support from the Southern Democrats when it came to agriculture if you just included some of their commodities. In fact, the Southerners were strong agriculturalists. So you learned quickly that ideological lines did not always hold, particularly when it came to some economic issues. Now I wish to make a few general comments about what I believe is my growth in the Senate from rather inauspicious beginnings, where I had no office for 19 days and literally had to live out of a suitcase and out of the helpful accommodations of Paul Porter's office. Those beginnings where I found open hostility from some of my Southern colleagues in the Senate, and at best from many of them, kind of a lifted eyebrow, wondering what sort of a fellow was this man from Minnesota. Yes, rather inauspicious beginnings where our press relations, at least on the national scene, were poor, oftentimes catastrophic. And yet I had won a significant victory in my home state, being the first elected Democrat to the United States Senate for 100 years, from statehood until 1948, Dash having defeated a powerful Republican senator and having undertaken the task of being mayor of a city that had immense problems and doing a rather good job of handling that city and its problems. Yet all of this did not seem to carry over when I went to Washington. I felt alone and lonely. I've sensed an inability to communicate what I wanted to do. And I also learned that while you may be doing well back in your home state, it doesn't necessarily carry over to the broader and the bigger scene at Washington or New York or the national level. Nevertheless, those first two or three years in the Senate were learning years for me, and I believe building years. I made up my mind that I would not give up or give in, that I would not indulge in self-pity, but rather that I would work and work and work as hard as I could, try to learn, and try to build some solid relationships with members of Congress, particularly the Senate, and with some members of the press, as well as in the general public. I did continue to cultivate my relationships with the labor movement, and to this very day, these relationships have been solid, constructive, lasting, and sincere. I began to feel that I was making some progress in the Senate after about the first 6 or 8 months. As I've indicated, one of the Southern senators that was kind to me was Senator Lister Hill of Alabama. His sense of good humor, his basic decency, his overall progressive orientation all appealed to me and also made it possible for him to extend his hand of friendship. There was Paul Douglas, who always helped me and gave me courage and strength. He was constantly at my side, being willing to defend me whenever it was needed. There was old Matthew Neely, the senator from West Virginia, who had a remarkable political career. He'd been mayor of the city of Fairmont, his hometown. He'd been congressman on several occasions. He was governor and United States senator. He'd resigned his position as congressman to run for governor and had gone from the governorship back to Congress and the Senate. He was a true friend of the people, a hard-hitting, Bible-thumping, old-fashioned, orating United States senator. He didn't speak often, but when he did, he spoke loudly, clearly, with authority, with keen wit, and at times both dry and raucous humor. He knew who his friends were and who were his enemies. He had a very strong, yes, he bitterly opposed Harry Byrd. He considered him a bad influence in the Senate and warned me to stay away. He was a friend of the coal miners, of John L. Lewis, an open and avowed advocate of organized labor. And yet he also voted for the depletion allowance for oil. He and I split on this one. He used to scold me, saying that I just didn't understand that that if you didn't have the depletion allowance, you wouldn't have any oil exploration. He never looked upon the depletion allowance as a tax loophole. He looked upon it as an incentive for production. And he fought against Paul Douglas and myself and others with whom he was most of the time associated. There was Senator Toby of New Hampshire, Republican, who extended his hand to friendship. He recalled meeting me when I was mayor of Minneapolis at a time when I came before one of the committees of Congress to testify on behalf of public housing and urban renewal. He always told the story about my visit before that committee. As I recall, when I appeared before the committee, I asked if I could tape record what I was saying. There was some discussion. Irving Ives, the senator from New York, a man whom I held in the highest esteem and with whom I developed a close friendship during our service together in the Senate. Well, in 1946 and 47, Irving Ives was chairman of a subcommittee holding hearings on housing. On that committee was Senator Toby, who I believe was the chairman of the overall committee of banking and currency. There was also Joe McCarthy, senator from Wisconsin. I came down as the mayor of Minneapolis to plead for some funds for housing and urban renewal and development. As I said, I asked to have it tape recorded. After some discussion, Senator Toby, in his inimitable staccato-like fashion, said, "Young man, what do you intend to do with this tape recording? Do you intend to use it back home?" And I said yes, that I intended to have it available for both radio and for playing to the members of the city council and other officers of government. He said, "Do you plan on running for office?" I said, "Possibly." He said, "Are you thinking about using this tape recording if you run for office?" And he said, much to his surprise, I answered yes. And then he went on to say that any man that's willing to be that honest about his intentions and motives ought to be granted the right to have a tape recording. And the committee proceeded in good humor and good nature, which I found to be the general custom of committees of Congress, if you give them a chance, to permit me to tape record my testimony. Well, Toby used to talk about that a great deal. Another gentleman that I grew to know was Arthur Vandenberg. He was the senior statesman, so to speak, of the Republican Party, the liberal, the former isolationist who had become a great internationalist and who had helped President Truman so much in those difficult years of 1946 and 48. Arthur Vandenberg took a fancy to me, so to speak, and would from time to time talk with me and counsel me. I remember one time when Senator Capehart, Senator Jenner, Senator Welker of Idaho, Senator Dworshak of Idaho, Senator Ken Wherry of Nebraska, and a few others of the real conservatives of the Republican Party in 1949 set out to give me a rough time on the Senate floor about ADA. I had become the president, the national president of ADA in 1949. The ADA was looked upon by these Republicans as a socialist instrument, a socialist organization. And I can recall Senator Capehart going after me hard and heavy on the whole, on the platform and the program of ADA. Senator Jenner, in his hard-hitting, caustic oratory, attacking ADA and those of us associated with it. This was a regular display on the Senate floor in 1949, 1950, in particular. And one day when Senator Capehart was attacking ADA and calling it a Fabian society, a bunch of socialists, and was pointing out that ADA was recommending all sorts of programs which were socialistic in nature, according to his definition of socialism, pointing out that ADA was wanting for America what the British Labour Party was giving to Great Britain. In other words, a socialist program. I was debating with Capehart and Jenner and others, and trying to answer their arguments. And the debate became very hot and furious. At one point, I believe it was Senator Capehart who shouted at me in anger, "Just name me one thing that Great Britain has that we don't have." And quick as a flash, I responded, "Westminster Abbey," which literally broke up the Senate. Those who were not engaged in the debate, but were viewing it as spectators and listeners, roared with laughter. It destroyed the entire argument. My response destroyed the entire argument of Capehart, Jenner, and company. There is nothing like a quick retort or humor to devastate the argument, to devastate the emotional, demagogic argument of an opponent. And this response of mine, which came almost automatically from me, just routed the opposition. Senator Toby came over and put his arm around me and said, "You really took them, really took these boys to the cleaners. Hats off to you." He had a sort of a New England cocky way of saying things. I can still see him with a broad smile on his face, delighted in what had happened, because these same Republicans were his opponents in the Republican Party. And then as I walked out the door, Senator Arthur Vandenberg came and put his arm around me and said, in so many words, "You really took them today, and don't you ever back away from them. You have proven that you are more than a match for them, and they'll respect you from here on out," which surely was the case. In those early days of the Senate, I had many difficult moments with what were known as the right-wing Republicans. And yet later on, I found that one could get along with them. In fact, as the years went by, I developed a friendship with Senator Homer Capehart of Indiana. And during my days as Majority Whip and Vice President, Senator Capehart would always call on me when he came to Washington. I believe that he really liked me, and I know that I reciprocated the same I know that I had the same feelings about him. And believe it or not, I started to get along quite well with Senator Jenner. I found that he had a great sense of humor. And as long as we kept off from certain explosive political issues, we had a splendid personal relationship. I found that Herman Welker, who seemed at times so mean and genuinely mean, really was not a mean man at all. He was the victim of unbelievable migraine headaches. And later on, as we now know, he was the victim of high blood pressure, which brought his death. One day he told me about his disability. And he actually told me that I was one of the few liberals. In fact, he put it, the only liberal in the Senate that he really liked. I don't know whether this was all true or not, but it came voluntarily from him. And I always was careful about Herman Welker, knowing that many days he was in pain and agony. And this undoubtedly conditioned some of his work. These men, none of whom I suppose agreed with me ideologically or philosophically, came around to be social friends, and I became good social friends with them, despite many bitter arguments in the early days. My first experience of any consequence relating to a debate in the Senate was over the tax bill of 1950. I had made up my mind that I was going to learn something about taxation. Frequently, people in the liberal movement were judged as liberals by the way they voted on appropriations. In other words, if they voted for big appropriations for housing or education, they were considered liberals. And I suppose, in part, that was one of the credentials or qualifications for the title liberal. It always appeared to me, however, that one needed to know more about where the money came from and who was paying the bill, as well as where it was going and who was getting the use of the money. In other words, if you were going to really be a good senator and true to liberal and progressive principles, you ought to not only be interested in legislation and appropriations, but also in the taxing policies of government. Were those tax policies fair? Did they bear unjustly upon those least able to pay? Or did they bear properly upon those best able to pay? Were there special privileges being granted to some that were not available to others? Could those so-called special privileges be justified in the national interest? For example, my friend Senator Matthew Neely felt that the oil depletion allowance was absolutely necessary for our national security, for the development of our oil resources. I considered the depletion allowance excessive. I agreed with him that there ought to be some depletion allowance because it was a natural resource that was being depleted as it was being used. And surely there ought to be incentive for exploration and development of production. But it seemed to me that the 27.5% oil depletion allowance was far too much. And there were all kinds of other built-in little tax privileges and tax loopholes that were available primarily to the rich but not to the poor or the middle income, that were available to business but not to the working man, that were available to a doctor but not to a school teacher. So I set out to learn something about the tax program. The administration had sent a tax bill to the Congress. President Truman gave leadership on tax policy. And I asked for some help from some intelligent young men who understood tax policy. Joseph Peckman, Charlie Davis, who was consul of the Department of the Treasury, and there were one or two others, but it was Peckman and Davis in particular that drilled me on the administration's tax proposals, many of which were reform measures, and also kept me fully acquainted with the proposals that were being considered in the House Ways and Means and the Senate Finance Committee. In other words, I took intensive training in tax policy. I asked Mr. Peckman and his associates, as well as Charlie Davis, the chief counsel of the Treasury Department, to educate me in the politics and the economics of tax policy. And along with Paul Douglas, who was an economist of fame in his own right, we set out, Paul and myself, to fight the tax bill. Now, no one had ever done this before, apparently. At least it was considered something that a freshman senator should never do. I was not on the Finance Committee, nor at that time was Senator Douglas on the Finance Committee. But we set out to debate. I had received some advice along the line that if you were going to challenge Senator Walter George of Georgia and Senator Eugene Milliken of Colorado, the chairman of the Finance Committee and the ranking Republican member, that you surely ought to be ready for a battle royal. George was a powerful debater and a powerful influence in the Senate. Eugene Milliken was brilliant and had a tongue on him like a saber, a sense of wit, charm, and eloquence. Both of them conservatives, but both of them brilliant and able senators. I took the liberty of going to Senator George and telling him that I was going to debate certain parts of the tax bill and to offer amendments. He took my observation in stride, said, "Well, proceed, go right ahead. That's what a senator is entitled to do." And I did do just that. But the fact that I had told him that I was going to debate it, I think, appealed to him as a responsible act, and that I was not trying to play to the galleries, but rather was trying to change tax law or at least find out the justifications for certain committee actions. Apparently, a good deal of the tax program in the past had gone through without too much debate, except on certain big issues. But Paul and I decided to debate the whole bill from beginning to end, and to offer a number of amendments and demand roll call votes. We did just this, and I think it was maybe one of the best debates that took place in the Congress during my 16 years as a senator. We did not succeed in our amendments, but we did prevent some of what we considered to be the more outrageous tax loopholes from being consummated. And when it was all over, both Senator George and Senator Milliken came over and congratulated me on the quality of the debate and my willingness to debate the tax bill and to offer in a responsible and constructive manner. I believe that that one experience in 1950 or 51, and I believe it went on into 51, had more to do with gaining the respect of Senator George than anything else I ever did. He told Lyndon Johnson years later that he considered me an intelligent and responsible senator, that while I was too liberal for his taste, that I at least was fair and honest and responsible. I think what I found was that some of the conservatives were willing, that many of the conservatives were willing to accept you as were willing to accept you and respect you as long as you maintain your liberal views, despite your liberal views, if you just didn't try to play to the grandstands all the time. In other words, if you would play fair, if you were prepared to debate your case, and if you fought hard and thoroughly. I made up my mind that I would do my homework, that I would not enter into any debate on any bill without being prepared and ready to debate it in detail and to the finish. I never contested the motives or impugned the motives of any of my colleagues in the Congress, in the Senate. I always made the case on the basis of honest differences of opinion and differences of philosophy. I found that as long as you treated the other senators as if they were honest men, sincere in their convictions, that you would be able to, in most instances, gain their respect and often their friendship, even though you may vote differently and disagree very openly and strongly. There is a code of honor in the Senate, and it consists in part of a great personal respect for the other senators, of never impugning their motives, and never casting doubt on their integrity or honesty. And never seeking to openly embarrass them by connivory, trickery, or any kind of double cross. You had to keep your word, and if you did those things, it made little or no difference to most senators how you voted or what amendments you offered or even what was your political philosophy. All of these things were considered to be your personal prerogatives, your rights. But those rights should not be extended to the point of abusing the rights of others by casting reflection on his character or contesting his integrity or his motives. As I think back over that debate on the tax bill, the Tax Act of 1950, I consider it the turning point in my career in the Senate. It was at this point that I had demonstrated that I wasn't just talkative, just another emotional liberal, but rather was a student of government, willing to work, willing to state my case, debate it, and call for a vote, accept the decision only to return to the fight another day. And I'm pleased that despite the fact that we had very little success in changing the tax law, that the contest was with men of such quality and ability as Senator George and Senator Milliken. By challenging the giants of the Senate and putting on a good battle, I not only gained their respect, but also the respect of many other senators. And just the fact that the response in debate by George or Milliken was respectful, and that it wasn't filled with scorn and ridicule, that within itself told the Senate that Senators Douglas and Humphrey were to be considered able senators, respected, and men of influence and power. That's the way I interpreted it. And I found from that year on that my fortunes in the Senate always improved, and particularly amongst the conservatives, many of whom bitterly opposed my political philosophy and activities, but generally spoke well of me as a person from that time on. In other words, I'd overcome what had been the bitterness of on the part of some over my civil rights stance, the disappointment on the part of the conservatives over my election, and the disdain of some over the fact that I was even in the Senate. It was in the Senator Richard Russell is one of the strong personalities and powerful figures in the United States Senate, and undoubtedly has been so for many years. I have observed him carefully, knowing that he was the master strategist and tactician of the Southern Bloc of Democrats, and really the foremost the foremost leader of the conservative bloc in the Congress. While it was often noted that it was Taft and Russell that put together the Republican Southern Democrat coalition, and frequently it was stated in the press that Taft was its leader, it is my view that the master strategist and the man who really mapped out the tactics to be followed and the objectives to be achieved was Dick Russell. I have a feeling that Russell did more to use Taft than Taft did to use Russell. Or to put it another way, that it was Senator Russell who was in charge, even if behind the scenes. No man was more knowledgeable about the rules of the Senate than Senator Russell. He understood that if you did not have the numbers, you had to have the knowledge of tactics, strategy, and maneuver, and be an expert in all of it. What Senator Russell understood very clearly was the use of power in the Senate. He knew that in order for himself and the group that he represented to achieve their objectives, they had to have a working coalition between themselves and the Republican conservatives. He also knew that on many issues this coalition could not hold together. So he was wise enough to use the coalition, or to put the coalition's strength to a test, only on those issues where he was reasonably sure that it would hold together and stand the test of pressure and partisan loyalties. I've always said that the Southern Democrats were the professional politicians. In sheer numbers, there was no reason to believe that they could really dominate the Senate. But like the British, they substituted knowledge of politics for sheer numbers and power and numerical power. They lived by their wits. To them, politics was not an avocation, but a vocation. The seniority system worked to their advantage. A Southern Democrat, if he did his work well, most likely would be reelected, and reelected again and again, thereby achieving seniority and power as a subcommittee chairman or a committee chairman. Also, the Southern Democrats, because they did achieve seniority and had continuity of service, soon found themselves in key positions on the policy committee of the Democratic Party and on the steering committee of the Democratic Senate majority or minority, whatever it was. In other words, a majority of the power positions were occupied by Southern Democrats, even when the Southern Democrats represented a small minority of the total Democratic strength. The reason? Well, they were there, and they were there over a long period of time. And liberals came and went, elected for a term or two terms, and then defeated. This was the problem posed by seniority, or should I say it was seniority that augmented the strength of the Southern Democrat. And the Southern Democrats also had a way of making friends. They always possessed good manners, a sense of graciousness, and yet a sense of group loyalty to their own group that never permitted a division in its ranks. In other words, the Southern senators stood as a block on issues that affected the South, with little or no defections. Northern Democrats, those from the East, the Midwest, and the Far West, would often split. They were very independent and had very and had much less sense of loyalty to either a region or a group. Then the Southerners had a way of being able to penetrate the ranks of other democratic groupings. For example, Theodore Francis Green, as liberal a senator as ever voted in the Senate, as ever served in the Senate, would from time to time align himself with Southerners on a number of issues. He never did so, however, on an issue like the filibuster or cloture or civil rights. But he would do so when it came to selecting the majority leader or the minority leader, whatever the case may be, or the majority whip. For example, Senator Lyndon Johnson, as senator, when he sought to be majority leader, had the unqualified full support of Theodore Francis Green. At the same time, he had the unqualified support of Dick Russell. The Southerners knew how to gain friends and influence people. They had a sense of humor. They were sociable. They didn't make every issue a major cause. They permitted their allies to have a great freedom of action, except when it came to those basic matters such as unlimited debate or some of the fundamental questions on civil rights or states' rights. What I'm trying to say is that the liberals generally demanded 90 to 100% purity in the liberal voting record on all liberal issues. The Southerners demanded only that amount of loyalty that was absolutely necessary for them to maintain their positions of control. When it came to a number of the other issues, such as the legislative issues, with the exception of civil rights and the changing of the rules of the Senate, there were no hard and fast demands made upon allies of the South. You could be an ally and a liberal and go your own way on almost everything except the rules change of the Senate and still be one of these and still have the goodwill, the backing and the confidence of the Southern strategists and leaders. But if you were in the liberal group and you deviated on any one major vote or any one vote, you would be looked upon as less than reliable. In other words, liberals have a tendency to demand a purity of performance that is almost beyond human capability. The Southerners recognize human fallibility, recognize the weaknesses of the flesh, and insisted only upon the minimums of regularity and the minimums of fidelity in order for you to qualify as a reliable associate and ally. Going back to Richard Russell, I would again note that his strength rested in his attention to detail. It appeared to me, as I observed him over the years, that all the different Southern senators had their assignments. They were to watch over certain matters and they stood together on those matters. The one thing that they always caucused about and upon which there was complete solidarity was the protection of the right of unlimited debate and the sanctity of the Senate rules. There was to be no flirtations with change or adaptation. You had to be a fundamentalist when it came to the Senate rules. It was in the Senate rules and the use of those rules, the knowledge of the rules, that the Southern leadership exercised power. even when they didn't have the numbers to justify it. Our Southern Democratic friends also were meticulous in watching over the distribution of power in the Senate. For example, I said a moment ago that because of the long service of Southern Democrats, in other words, their seniority, they found themselves in due time with a disproportionate number of their members on the Majority Policy Committee. For example, no majority leader is ever elected without the support of the Southerners, and no majority leader is elected if, and no one is elected majority leader if he has the opposition of the Southerners. And the same thing is true of the majority whip. The Southerners either mastermind the your election as a majority leader, or they exercise veto over your selection of a would-be majority leader. How do they do this? By working their way into the chief consuls of the Senate. They become committee chairmen, subcommittee chairmen through seniority, heads of special committees. They occupy, in other words, the establishment of the Senate, including the appointment of the parliamentarian, the clerks of the Senate, the key officers of the Senate. None of them get their positions without either being the nominees of the Southern Democrats or the acquiescence of them. The Southern Democratic leadership can always exercise veto. Now you might ask, how come if there's only, let's say, 20 to 24 of them in the Southern bloc, and there are 50 or 60 Democratic senators, how is it that a minority exercises that much power? The reason is simple. They stand together. The others are split apart. There are always defections. There are always those who split off. And then the Southerners also are able to bring in as allies those who understand that the best way to get along in the Senate is to get along with chairman and subcommittee chairman and the power structure, so that the Southern bloc, by standing together, by having seniority, commands the main positions of power and actually determines in many instances what will happen to other senators in such matters as assignment to committees and the extra emoluments of office that come with serving in the Senate. Take, for example, new senators, or the reassignments of senators who seek new committee posts. That steering committee consists in a very large measure of powerful Southern Democrats who have had long service in the Senate. Again, while they do not necessarily represent a majority of the steering committee, they represent a sufficient number, plus their years of experience and influence as committee chairman, so as to have their recommendations generally accepted and their decision. Senator Lyndon Johnson came to the Senate in 1949, just as I did. He got in with a very small vote, as we know. In fact, it was contested in the courts. You might ask, then, how come a man who barely made it to the Senate was to become such a powerful figure in such a short period of time? In fact, he was at power the day he stepped into the Senate. I think the answer lies in the fact that Senator Johnson had many years in the House of Representatives, but more significantly, in those years, he had developed a relationship first with Franklin Roosevelt, and secondly, that he was the protege of the Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn. And being And having those connections and that fortunate background of association, he carried with him influence over and beyond just the title of United States Senator. Furthermore, he worked very closely with Southern congressmen during his days in the House. He knew them, he worked with them, he had their confidence and their friendship. He was a congressman to the utmost. In other words, he lived the life of Congress. He spent his time in Congress. He cultivated friends in Congress. He understood the workings of Congress and the apparatus itself, and was able to, when he came to the United States Senate, to not be a newcomer, but in fact was an old-timer, even though not an old man. He had been in Washington, D.C. for better than 20 years, and he knew his way around, and he knew all the power positions, the pressure points. He knew where the lobbyists were, who they were. He understood the structure of government and the work and the structure of the Congress, including not only the elected members of Congress, those that he had known over the many years, but the appointee of officials, the appointed officials of the Congress. In other words, he understood the establishment and was a part of it. His senior colleague in the Senate was Senator Tom Connally, who was a powerful figure and the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1949. So Senator Johnson came in with good credentials. He also was a friend of the Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, and that friendship was strengthened and cultivated and made more enduring every day of Senator Johnson's service in the United States Senate. Very few people have understood the political techniques, tactics, and operations of Senator Lyndon Johnson. When he became the majority whip, Lyndon Johnson stood by the Southern bloc when it came to the rules of the Senate. But he was much more liberal and progressive in his overall political philosophy than most of his Southern friends. He cultivated the friendship of Harry Flood Byrd, of Walter George, and as I said, of Dick Russell. These were confidants of his, counselors, and advisors. They were also men with whom he worked and later on was able to draw upon for important assignments and assistance when he became majority leader and president of the United States. What I seek to emphasize is that Lyndon Johnson as senator, made it his business to have an alliance, a working alliance and relationship with the Southern Bloc, but never to let them fully control him. He, in a sense, used the bloc more than they were able to use him. He always, however, had their support. At the same time, he would have the support of such outstanding liberals as Theodore Francis Green and a number of the other Northern liberals whom ordinarily would have been at odds with the Southerners. Lyndon Johnson, while having the benefit of Southern support, never viewed himself as a Southerner. He was a Democrat and a Texan, enjoying the benefits of Southern hospitality and Southern power and Southern support, but carefully avoiding some of the liabilities of being designated a Southerner by his contacts with the people outside of the Southern Bloc and his careful cultivation of them. For example, David Dubinsky of the International Lady Garment Workers Union was a personal friend of Lyndon Johnson. This went back to the days when there was a struggle over minimum wage, and Lyndon Johnson is a member of the House. strongly supported the minimum wage law, when other members of the Texas delegation were refusing to do so. David Dubinsky never forgot that, nor did Lyndon Johnson ever forget David Dubinsky, and the two constantly reminded each other of their respective roles in historic legislation. Likewise, Lyndon Johnson was a friend of agriculture, of rural electrification. He was a friend of those persons who were interested in health research and Social Security. He had a liberal, progressive legislative record without at the same time losing the confidence or the support of the Southerners. Now why? Because on matters of rules of the Senate, he never let them down, even though he nudged the Southerners from time to time to make some modification of the rules, but never to the point where it broke their power in terms of the use of the filibuster or unlimited debate. Likewise, while Lyndon Johnson was much more forward-looking on civil rights than his Southern friends, he never went so far as a senator as to try to force down the throat of the Southerners civil rights legislation that was beyond what they could take. It is known that in 1957, as well as in 1960, civil rights laws were passed, and these laws were forward steps. But in each instance, when certain points came in the debate on civil rights, Johnson would be able to protect what were the demands of the Southerners, even though he was making advances which pleased some of the Northerners. It was one of the most adroit political maneuvers and the use of political tactics that the Congress has ever known. For example, on the issue of whether or not on some matters of civil rights there should be jury trials, Northern liberals were opposed to jury trials because Southern juries were proclaimed to be, and there was good evidence to substantiate this claim, that they were unfair when it came to the protection of the rights of a Negro. A good deal of evidence was brought into the record to demonstrate this claim. However, the cry of the trial by jury was as American as apple pie, and the Southerners were insisting that there should be jury trials where there were charges of violation of civil rights. The Northerners were saying that it should not be a jury trial, that it could be done by a contempt of court proceeding where the judge himself could rule without a jury, while the Northern case made sense in terms of effective enforcement. The Southern claim made more sense in terms of public understanding and of public acceptance. Who can really be against jury trial in America? It's one of the historic rights coming back from the time of Magna Carta in the common law. And what Lyndon Johnson was able to do was to take a situation where the pro-civil rights leaders in the Congress had proceeded to a point of seeking enforcement of civil rights law by an order of a judge, and let that argument gain considerable momentum, and then at the right time to be able to line up the votes to save the South on the issue of jury trial. What he accomplished was, first of all, passage of important civil rights law, but at the same time giving the South a victory on the jury trial amendment, thereby saving face for them, as the South had to accept federal intervention in the issue in civil rights, federal law in the field of civil rights. But in accepting that federal law, or having that law passed over their objection, the Southerners were able to at least get an amendment which they were able to say to their own constituents was the important amendment, namely the right of a trial by jury, and that the jury would be, of course, a Southern jury of Southern people in the region, in the area where the abridgment of civil rights was claimed to have taken place. What this demonstrates is that Lyndon Johnson was a master tactician, but he also was a progressive. He wanted to see progress in the fields of social welfare and social legislation and civil rights, but he understood that in order to get it, you had to bring along some of the Southerners, or you had to at least permit them to save face, to have some victories along with the fundamental changes that were taking place in federal law and federal activity. Lyndon Johnson also did something in reference to new senators that bears comment. Prior to his becoming majority leader, and he became majority leader with the active support of the Southern Bloc, no new senator, when in his first year, would be given any major committee assignment. Generally, you were assigned to, and when I say major committee, I mean appropriations or finance or judiciary, one of the powerful committees of the Congress. But Lyndon Johnson made it a rule that every new senator would have at least one major committee on which he would serve. Now, this didn't mean too much in actual practice because many times new senators did get major committees even before the rule, but not all of them got major committees. What Johnson did was to take what was already developing as a practice and to make it a rule and to announce it as his rule and to fulfill it. It had a very good effect. He also made it possible for a number of liberal senators to find their way or to get to important committees such as the Committee on Finance, on Appropriations, Foreign Relations, the powerful committees of the Senate. It was in finance that tax reform would take place and Social Security legislation to be adopted, such as Medicare. It was in appropriations where the funds for a number of the social welfare programs would have to be allocated and appropriated, or at least recommended. And it was in the Judiciary Committee where civil rights legislation would be processed. Now, in these major committees, in these three, and in foreign relations, great matters of foreign policy, particularly on foreign aid, were to be processed. In all three of these committees, there had been a predominance of Southern strength. Lyndon Johnson, supported by the Southerners in his election as majority leader, was the first majority leader through his recommendations and influence as chairman of the steering committee and of the policy committee. He was the first majority leader to assign or recommend the assignment of senators like Paul Douglas to finance, for example, or a senator like Albert Gore to finance. True fighting liberals in the tax field, or a senator such as Quentin Burdick to the judiciary, or Philip Hart, true civil liberty advocates, or senators like myself and Mansfield to appropriations, and Senator McGee of Wyoming, for example, to appropriations. The man, in other words, that gained his power with the support and help of the Southern Bloc actually became the man who over his years of service as majority leader and in president was to dilute the power of the Southern Bloc. It was Lyndon Johnson, as majority leader, who passed the first civil rights laws, despite Southern objection, even though he gave Southerners some victory in this jury trial amendment. It was Lyndon Johnson who announced the rule that each new senator would have a major committee assignment, thereby, in a sense, preventing Southern veto of certain senators to important committees, and thereby diluting the Southern control and power of all of these committees. It was Lyndon Johnson, as majority leader of the United States Senate, who placed a person such as myself on the steering committee and other liberals, where we would have something more to say about the assignment of senators to their respective committee posts. It was Lyndon Johnson who helped propose a modification of what is known as the cloture rule, so that cloture would no longer be two-thirds of those present and voting. I mean two-thirds of the total Senate, but two-thirds of those present and voting. While not much of a modification, it represented some change in the rules. And there were other changes. In other words, the untouchable rules of the Senate were touched and adjusted and changed under the leadership of Lyndon Johnson, a leader who had the active support of, and in a sense was sponsored by, the Southern Bloc. How was this done? Primarily because Lyndon Johnson had these direct personal relationships with the key movers and leaders of the Southern Bloc, as well as of other groupings in the Senate. He spent his full time working with, talking to, talking with, talking at, and working over senators, and also controlling the apparatus of the United States Senate. And that control over apparatus was very important, because the secretary to the majority, the secretary of the Senate, the sergeant of arms, and others, none of whom were ever appointed without the blessing of and the recommendation of the majority leader, could do so much to be of help to a senator, or, if they were so ordered, could do a great deal to make it more difficult for a senator. Lyndon Johnson knew how to use every one of these little levers or levers of power, and he used them carefully, but he used them whenever he needed to. One thing I noticed about Lyndon Johnson was that he seldom talked to people in groups. He talked to you individually. He would get individual commitments from senators. He never made a move that was going to be objectionable to the Southerners, but what he told them about it before it happened. He tried to condition them as to what its effect would be. Indeed, I suppose he tried to talk them out of opposing it, his move. But he always gave them forewarning, and at the same time tried to appeal to his best friends in the Southern Bloc not to make it too difficult. And I gather at the appropriate moment he would always have some modest face-saving amendment that one of the Southerners would sponsor that would be acceptable to him, and that he could drive through with his strong leadership over the objections of what was known as the liberal bloc. I think it should be remembered that there was a liberal bloc about the same size in numbers as the Southern bloc, about 20 to 24, just as there were anywhere from 20 to 24 Southerners. And there was always another bloc of 10 to 20 or more that was neither Southern nor liberal. And it was in this particular group that Lyndon Johnson had his element of strength, that extra measure of strength that made it possible for him to be a very effective legislative leader and majority leader. Lyndon Johnson is president with his close friend Richard Russell, did more than any other president to again dilute the power of the Confederacy. It was Lyndon Johnson who masterminded the passage of the Civil Rights Act and insisted upon the Senate breaking the filibuster and applying cloture and keeping that act from being weakened or diluted. It was Lyndon Johnson who did more to get legislation of national purpose and national commitment than any other president in modern times. It was Lyndon Johnson as president who, by sponsoring the voting rights legislation, as well as the civil rights legislation, proceeded to undermine the power structure of the South, both in the local areas as well as in the Congress. It was Lyndon Johnson as president who did more to pass legislation in education, fields of education, and health, and conservation, and environment, and other areas, all of which had a national purpose with national standards, national goals, and national commitments, none of which paid homage to or lip service to states' rights, but rather called upon states to be partners in the achievement of national goals and national purposes. So here was a man as president from Texas who rose to power both in the Congress and in the presidency with the active support of the key leaders of the South. And all during that rise to power, he used that power to dilute the strength of the South in terms of its control over the committees of Congress, the structure and apparatus of Congress, and the legislation passed by Congress. And as president, he used the power of his office and the talents that were his to drive through the most far-reaching legislation that this country has ever known in the fields of social welfare, civil rights, and education, most of which had been bitterly opposed by Southern leadership in the Congress, Southern governors, and the Southern Democratic power structure. Nevertheless, a man from Texas, a man who rose to power, standing on the shoulders of Southern leaders and being given the helping hand of Southern leaders, this same man, when put to the test as to whether or not he was a Southerner or a national leader, proved himself to be a national leader and did more than any man in our time to put restraints on the power of the South, to weaken that power, its political power, to dilute the power of the Southern leadership in the Congress, and to state the national purpose as superseding that of any state or local purpose. Such are the ironies of politics. Such are the paradoxes of our time.
Maybe you play down your bowl in there.
During all of this performance of Lyndon Johnson as majority leader and president, he maintained the closest of relationships with the Southern senators and congressmen. They were constantly called into his office for consultation, for visits, for encouragement, or at times when he needed to restrain their opposition. And as president, I witnessed Lyndon Johnson time after time spending hours with men like Dick Russell, Russell Long of Louisiana, John Stennis of Mississippi, John McClellan of Arkansas, and others of the Southern group, as he sought to bring them around in support of his programs or to minimize their opposition to his policies and programs, but always to maintain a close personal relationship, which I'm sure was very helpful in keeping down the level of bitterness and acrimony which all too often conditions American political life. Lyndon Johnson understood the politics of Congress as few men. He understood the men of the Congress. He knew how to appeal to their vanity, to their needs, to their hopes. And he did not hesitate to use every tool of the trade that he had learned and that he knew by intuition or natural talent. He used all of them to achieve his goals and his purposes. Paragraph. My relationships with Lyndon Johnson started, as I've indicated, in around 1950. Our relationships at first were perfunctory and social. I recall being invited into his office for an afternoon or an early evening drink. Actually, my first contacts with him were due to some advice given me by Senator Russell Long. Russell Long told me that I was making a mistake by not dining from time to time, having lunch from time to time in the inner dining room that was reserved entirely for members of the Senate and no outside people whatsoever. Now, this is a little special dining room, separate and distinct from what is known as the Senate dining room. This dining room is divided into two sections, one that is occupied by Republican senators, and another just beyond an open door that is occupied by Democratic senators. The members who use the dining room were generally what you might call the leaders of the Senate, the committee chairmen, the older senators. On the advice of Russell Long, I started to go from time to time at the lunch hour, at the noon hour, into that little section of the private Senate dining room for Senate Democrats. And who would I find there at the table? And it was like a large community table or a dining room table in your own home. There you would find Dick Russell or John Stennis or Jim Eastland or John McClellan or Russell Long or Lister Hill. You would find other members of the more conservative side of the Democratic majority in the Senate. And the lunch hours would be always filled with good social talk, seldom anything on issues, many good stories, where you got to know the members of the Senate as human beings, as men, as individuals, rather than as political leaders or politicians. And it was in this milieu and environment that I was at my best, because I enjoyed the conversation and the sociability, and I found that the members in attendance at that lunch room seemed to enjoy my comments and my manner. I believe that it was here that I began to develop that spirit of friendship and comradeship, which is so essential if you were to be at all effective in the Senate. From time to time, Lyndon Johnson would stop into this room. He did so to be close to the members of the Senate that he needed. And on some occasions when I would see him there, he would maybe ask me to stop by his office, if only for a brief visit. It was one way that he had of showing two things: that he wanted to talk with you, to get to know you, and secondly, that he was taking leadership and asking you to come to his office. It was just another example of his initiative and of his leadership. When he became minority leader, when he became the majority whip, he would from time to time ask me to do certain things in the Senate. And when he became majority leader, I was taken into his confidence repeatedly on matters that he sought to accomplish in the Senate. He appointed several of us, men like myself and Senator Smathers, as deputy leaders. We, in other words, were given title by his magic wand, so to speak, to undertake certain responsibilities. I remember that he asked me to take care of what he called the bomb throwers. These were the liberals, Paul Douglas, Estes Kefauver, Herbert Lehman, of course myself, and members of that group, the class of the 81st Congress, the ADA friends and members, the liberal Democrats that had solid organized labor support. These were the what he called the bomb throwers. And I was to be their spokesman, not by their election, but by his appointment. That he wanted me to find out what they wanted, and he wanted me to report to him. I was called upon to make recommendations to him as majority leader as to what some of these senators wanted in terms of committee assignments. And our relationship began in a very sincere and effective manner in the mid-1950s. The relationships between myself and Lyndon Johnson were based primarily upon the matter of mutual need, what we could do for each other. I knew that if I was to do well in the Senate, to exercise, to be able to achieve some of the goals that I had in mind, in legislation particularly, that I was going to need to be able to work closely with the majority leader and to have his confidence. Also, I know that Lyndon Johnson felt that he needed me. Part of my success in getting along with Lyndon Johnson and developing a warm personal relationship with him was because I tended to the duties of a senator. I believe I ran a good Senate office, taking care of constituent mail and inquiries and requests, handling constituent cases that related to problems of the citizen with the government, and working assiduously, methodically, and with considerable detail on problems of legislation. I was able to debate my case when I presented new legislative proposals or amendments to legislative proposals that were pending on the floor. I always abided by the rules of the Senate, respected my colleagues in debate. I do not believe that I ever became personal in my argument with my Senate colleagues, but nevertheless, fought hard for the things that in which I believed. All of this gained some respect from the older members of the Senate, and particularly from what I would call the Senate professionals, those who made politics not an avocation but a vocation. And this was particularly true of the Southern Democrats and some of the conservative Northern Republicans. Lyndon Johnson possibly saw in me some of the same qualities that he found in himself, namely the ability to get along with people of different walks of life, different philosophies and attitudes. I have always been able to do this and felt that this was an essential role for any successful political leader. If all you can do is to rally those who see, to rally those around you who see things exactly as you do, you'll always be leading a minority and seldom be in charge of a majority. What you have to seek out are common denominators amongst diverse people. Or to put it another way, to seek some common objectives amongst people who have different points of view on a host of different issues. This requires a very sensitive political antenna, but above all, it requires good personal relationships. The Senate of the United States, while it is a political forum and a highly structured parliamentary body, is after all a group of men and women who are working together, in a sense almost living together, talking together, thinking together, and hopefully coming to some conclusions. Personal relations, therefore, are very important, indeed vital and at times controlling. Seldom do individuals feel so strongly on an issue that they will refuse to discuss it rationally or sensibly, informally or in a friendly manner with another person. There are some major issues that divide people on party lines. There are some major legislative issues that divide people on ideology and philosophy. But frequently, the issues are not of that consequence or importance, and therefore, the individual that is able to maintain a close personal relationship with other members of the Senate is often able to get his amendment adopted, his legislation passed, if not in its original form, at least in an acceptable form. This leads me to make comment upon what I call the art of compromise. There are those who live by political expediency. This obviously has definite shortcomings and limitations, and means that in the long run that you are without principle and without program or consistency. There are others who live by the strict rule that what they think is right, and they will compromise nowhere on anything except to insist that everyone follow their thinking. In other words, they play the music and you are to march. And you cannot march in your own cadence, but you will march to their trumpet and to their beat. That sort of an individual seldom gets anything done, and if he does, it's most likely wrong, and the procedure is dangerous because it leaves no room for human adjustment or for flexibility or for even the necessary compromises that are required for effective legislation. I always believed that there were at least two steps that one had to follow in the legislative process. First, know what you want. Draw up your bill or your proposed legislation along the lines of what you believe would be the very best that you could obtain, and fight for it. Outline your arguments, develop those arguments for your legislative proposal or your particular idea. Be strong in your advocacy, and then constantly keep in mind that you may have to make some retreat, some adjustment, in order to accomplish anything. In other words, to be willing to trim sail without abandoning course or destination. Being willing to digress or to even deviate from the straight line course in order to arrive at objective. This is what we mean by being willing to accept compromises that do not destroy principle and do not destroy the achievement of the fulfillment of your objective. Now, it is a fact that some of these objectives are delayed, or the fulfillment of objectives are delayed by compromise procedures or the acceptance of compromise. But I have always believed that you should fight hard for what you want, hopefully that you'll get exactly what you want, but being prepared to take less and always feeling that it is better to gain a foot than to stand still, even though you are searching and seeking to gain a mile. Now, there are times when a proposal may come before the Senate where it is better to lose than to win if in the process of winning you actually destroy the possibility of ultimate success of what you are after. But to make losing a habit in the name of moral principle or liberal conviction is to fail to govern and to demonstrate the incapacity to persuade, convince, and to develop a majority. Lyndon Johnson was what I would call a man that was perfectly willing to stop at halfway houses as long as he knew where he was going. As a liberal senator, I preferred to make the full journey, but always recognized that it may be necessary somewhere along the way to stop for a time, to settle for less than what you had anticipated or hoped for, but to constantly keep in mind that you were going to achieve what you set out for. This is what I would call the pragmatism of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt never gave up his objectives or his ideals, but he was willing to settle for less at a particular time in order to regroup his forces and to come back for a renewed attempt to gain further ground. What I'm saying is that a journey to a particular point does not all have to be achieved in a marathon run. You can stop off for refreshment. You can hold up to regroup your forces or to recover your strength, provided that you keep in mind where you're going and that you will ultimately achieve your destination. This is what I consider to be the pragmatic approach to legislation. Knowing what you want, fighting for it, doing everything possible to achieve it in one stroke, but if unable to do so, to be willing to make small gains, but constantly keeping in mind that each gain is but another launching platform for a further effort and for the ultimate fulfillment of objective. Now, when a senator takes this particular approach, particularly if he is stereotyped as a political liberal, he is bound to engage the wrath and the disdain of some of his fellow liberals, particularly in the intellectual community. There are those people that feel that any compromise is a sellout. I consider these particular individuals to be not only impractical, but frankly deceitful, because they know if they have any common sense at all, that in a democratic society and in a parliamentary body where the lines are, where majorities are constantly fluctuating, and where a majority on one issue today is a minority on another issue tomorrow, that it is literally impossible for any one senator or small group of senators to get his own or their own way exactly as they want it. Government requires the best in human relations, and human relations requires learning how to live together to make those adjustments and compromises which make a situation livable, tolerable, and at the same time lends itself to progress and development. But the wrath of the intellectual liberal who can see only utopia and is unwilling to lay the bricks and the mortar to build the temple is something that you have to experience in order to fully appreciate it. Yet we need all kinds of people in order to build a democratic system and to keep it moving. We need people who demand the best, because if we didn't have them, I'm afraid much of what we get would be the worst. We need people who are really self-appointed moralists in order to challenge those of us who feel that pragmatism may be the better method. Because pragmatism can lend itself to any kind of rationalization, or can lend itself to a rationalization of any process or development, whether it be good or bad. So we need in the Senate, as we need in the public, just as we need in education and in the media, people who demand more than humankind can deliver. Because it's only when the demands are high that the achievements are worthy of note. people have to live under tension, or they accomplish little or nothing. It is tension which brings out the best, and it is conflict of ideas which promotes good ideas and refines those that ultimately gain acceptance. Therefore, while I can be critical of those who have been critical of the compromisers in legislation, I must say that without people are constantly measuring your achievements by their own standards of perfection, you would have very little progress either in society as a whole or in the legislative process. Now, I've been asked to comment a bit on some personal assessments of individual senators. I've done so on Lyndon Johnson and Walter George and Richard Russell. Let me comment on Paul Douglas. As I've said, Senator Douglas was one of my dearest friends and continues to be to this day. He's a gentleman that I respect not only because of the keenness of his intellect, but also because of his incredible courage, both physical and moral. The life of Paul Douglas is well known. Once a pacifist who joined the Marines in World War II, despite some physical disabilities, went into battle, was a combat veteran, wounded, rose up from the ranks of private to an officer, and did remarkable things for his country. He's also a great teacher and has been all of his life, and respected and noted economist, but willing even then in those days at the University of Chicago to enter politics at the local level, entering into the city council, and being a reform councilman and yet working within the system, working with the structure of government, but never being content with it as it was, always seeking to make it better. When Paul Douglas came to the Senate in 1948, he was obviously a man to be watched and indeed one that the press looked upon as a truly great man, simply on the basis of his record to that time. That greatness grew and expanded as he continued his service in the United States Senate. Paul Douglas was what I would call a conservative liberal, strange as it may sound, or should I say a prudent liberal. I think that's better. Very liberal in terms of human relations, in terms of the role and the use of government to improve the lot of humankind. But a man that watched the nickels and the dimes, and he was not only an economist, but he was an economizer. He coined such words as wastrel, W-A-S-T-E-R-E-L, for those that would appropriate monies willy-nilly and have little or no concern over how they were expended. Paul Douglas, in other words, wanted a full dollar's worth of service out of each dollar appropriated. And there were times that I voted differently than Paul on the matters of appropriations, when I thought that he was too tight, too unwilling to spend from the public purse for what I believe to be legitimate objectives. I've never believed that government could be too efficient, that efficiency in government was, that the kind of efficiency in government that many business people talked about really didn't even prevail in business itself. But to have that kind of efficiency where there were few, if any, mistakes, and where the cost accounting became the standard of public service and public conduct, that I believe that such kind of government would be dehumanized, would be insensitive to social needs, would have to be put into a kind of a fiscal and bureau and budgetary straitjacket, that would fail to take into consideration the fallibilities of humankind, the differences in our culture and cultural patterns, all the many personal and social things which make up what we call our way of life and our democracy. Senator Douglas was recognized as a scholar when he came to the Senate, and he demonstrated those qualities of scholarship every day of his senatorial career. In other words, he spoke only when he was well prepared. He was a master of research. He knew how to build an argument. He understood the rational process, and he applied it religiously and strictly to legislative programs. He was unafraid in the Senate as he was in the battlefield. He took on the conservatives, and many times was treated them in a hard and in a firm and rough manner. He has a soft heart and a keen and hard mind. He was capable of tears when there was social injustice, and even as he explained it and discussed it in argument. But he was also capable of a quality of reasoning and argument that was as sharp and as precise as the finely honed edge of a saber or razor. Paul's areas of interest were, of course, tax legislation, all matters that related to finance and fiscal policy. No one was better equipped to discuss fiscal policy than Paul Douglas, and he did discuss it and educated the Senate in it. I know of no one in recent days that could even come close to him. He was the man that could stand up to Eugene Milliken or Walter George on any occasion and debate tax policy, not only with hammer blows of effectiveness, but with scholarship and professional knowledge of economics that few, if any, in the Senate had. His interest in what we call social welfare was genuine and constantly grew. Yet he was no patsy for some ne'er-do-well organization or plan. He was a friend of organized labor, but refused to take orders from it. I know of no senator outside possibly of Herbert Lehman, who, by the way, was a close friend of mine and of Paul Douglas. I know of no senator that was more immune to the pressure of lobbies than Paul Douglas. He always had a good staff, too, but I thought he did more for his staff than his staff may have done for him, simply because of his brilliance. While Paul was what you might call a true liberal, that is, an unblemished, pure one, he understood the realities of politics, and he would make his adjustments in the Senate as he had to in life itself. But he never abandoned principle, and he always came back to fight another day. He was a stalwart in matters relating to civil rights and immigration legislation, issues of great principle, and there was no compromise there. And indeed, it was in these areas that I thoroughly agreed with him on the basis of no compromise. We had to have effective national legislation if we were going to make any progress in the field of civil rights. And we simply had to abandon and cast aside the old quota system of the immigration law of the 1920s if we were going to bring any sense of decency to our immigration policy. And Paul Douglas and Herbert Lehman and Hubert Humphrey were in the forefront of the battles for civil rights legislation and immigration and a change in immigration policy. It took us a lot of time. We kept at it for years. People may have forgotten this or tend to forget it. But the struggle for civil rights started in the Senate of the United States when we arrived there in 1949, and we never ceased in our battle until it was accomplished in 1964. The same was true of the field in the field of immigration legislation. We had what we called our long immigration bill, the overall comprehensive reform of immigration legislation, and the short bill, which would do certain things that would permit family reunions, for example, that would accomplish some short-term gains. In this field of immigration, we also had the help and the support of John Kennedy, the young senator from the state of Massachusetts. He was not as active in civil rights, even though he voted with us most of the time. However, he did give his vote for the Southern proposal of jury trial, which have gained him considerable support among Southerners, and surely didn't, our opposition to it did not gain much, my opposition to that principle, or to that proposal, did not help me with the Southerners. But on immigration, John Kennedy was a stalwart. Even though he did not carry the fight on the major bill, he did so on the short bill, and I was a co-sponsor with him during those years that he served in the Senate. But Paul Douglas was out there battling day in and day out, as he did, for example, on housing. He was looked upon as an expert in this field again, and was one of those that that helped John Sparkman in the Committee on Banking and Currency design long-term housing policy. He also was a proponent of national health insurance, but he didn't go quite so far here as the Murray-Dingle bill, the one which I had co-sponsored. Rather, he came along with what was known as catastrophic health insurance, that is, health insurance for catastrophic cases, for extended hospital care, for the high cost of medical care. It was a compromised position. I notice now in the year 1970 that this position seems to gain some currency in the present Nixon administration. But Paul Douglas proposed it and a much more sensible proposal back in the 1950s. It was a backup position, a retreat position from comprehensive national health insurance. And now that I look back at it, it seems that it would have been wise for us to have tried to get behind that and achieve it. I was willing to support Paul in this, but we couldn't muster enough support for any kind of health insurance proposal to make it effective. He was an active proponent of Medicare. In other words, once again, in the field of social policy and social security, he was looked upon as an expert. He had been a consultant to governors and state legislatures when he was an economist out at the University of Chicago. And when I say consultant, I mean in the fields of social security. For example, he went to the state of Iowa and helped them write their state unemployment compensation law. He was one of those that helped draft the original material for the Social Security Act of back in the 1930s. So his word in Social Security and his knowledge of its background and intricacies of it was a very persuasive force in the Senate of the United States. I summarize my work with Paul Douglas on this basis, that I was like his student, learning from him. But I also think that Paul grew to respect me for my, not only my enthusiasm, my energy and hard work, but also for my knowledge of legislative issues. I recall that Muriel once received a telegram from Paul Douglas after the debate on the tax bill in 1950, when he said that I had proven myself to be a keen student of tax policy and legislation. It was a highly complimentary telegram. Paul always defended me. If I was under attack in the Senate, I could look to him and know that he would be there without even a request to stand up and speak in my behalf. What a remarkable man. Now a few words about Herbert Lehman, the little giant of the Senate, a man whose career some people thought was finished before he arrived to the Senate, but actually the greatest moments of his public life were yet to come as a senator. I can still see him walking down the center aisle of the Senate, fighting for what he believed, battling for his legislative proposals, fighting against the efforts of the conservatives in the Senate to ride through some bill roughshod. And he would stand his ground like a little giant. He was unperturbed by any kind of criticism. He was a man who was at the zenith of his power, who knew that his greatest days were being lived every day of his life. And he never hesitated to say what he believed and to be a powerful liberal force in the Senate of the United States. He and Paul Douglas were amazing men, different in many ways, but men of great principle and yet good, solid Democrats who understood the meaning of loyalty to the Democratic Party, who were willing to battle for what they believed was right. I think of all the men that I've known who was a man of political principle, none will measure higher than Herbert Lehman. I would put him at the head of the list. He represented a great state with many different peoples, but his political persuasion and attitude were always liberal and progressive and forward-looking. And he spoke with from a wealth of experience all the way back from the days of his association with Al Smith up through his association with Roosevelt as governor of the state of New York, as director of UNRRA, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. This man had an amazing political career, and much of it started at a point in his life when he was beyond the age of 50. And there he was in the Senate in the late 70s and 80s, pounding away like a young man. I was privileged to share in his friendship and to know him as not only a great senator, but as a warm and wonderful human being. His wife, what's her name? Herbert's wife, Edith, would be there in the galleries of the Senate watching over her husband with tender, loving attention and care. She was worried that Herbert was working too hard, and that he did. His health was not always the best, but he never let health or personal comfort or convenience stand in the way of what he thought was his public duty. And when it came to matters relating to civil rights and immigration, to civil liberties, there was none that was better than Herbert. And he always gave me new strength and courage. Whenever I felt a little weak or had a feeling that I might be faltering in my determination, all I needed to do was to watch Herbert.